President's Press Conference, March 29th, 1951.
Kenny, I've got two or three statements here, and one of them's not quite all committed right here, so you better get the two or three sharp pencils. I was sure that you'd be asking me some questions on this subject, and I thought I might as well tell you about it, and then hope my may bring some questions to mind that you otherwise wouldn't ask. This is every war has left a trail of crime in its wake, and the last war did that too. I've been deeply concerned about it, and we've been taking positive steps to combat it. As early as 1946, the Attorney General convened a national conference for the prevention and control of juvenile delinquency. This was an effort to eliminate crime at root, and the program is having good results. In the meantime, we have been studying quietly, but consistently, the problem of adult crime, particularly organized crime, which spills over state boundaries. About a year ago, I directed the Attorney General to call a conference of federal, state, and municipal enforcement officials. This conference produced some proposals for a cooperative attack on crime, which are already being used, and produce other proposals which are being carefully studied. At my direction, the Attorney General has also, during the last 18 months, this is with a special order of my own, convened special grand juries in Miami, Los Angeles, Kansas City, Newark, Philadelphia, and Scranton to seek out offenders against the federal tax, narcotics, white slave, and other laws. In the regular course of its work, the Justice Department filed over 36 criminal cases in the last fiscal year. Many notorious gangsters have been and are being prosecuted under these federal statutes. In addition, the Treasury and Justice Departments have, under my orders, given unstinted cooperation to the present Senate committee to investigate organized crime and interstate commerce. The committee deserves great credit for focusing public attention on the need for ever greater efforts to stamp out crime. The eradication of crime is a job for everyone. The federal government cannot evade its responsibilities any more than the state and the municipal government can. And above all, the individual citizens cannot evade their responsibility for their patronage without which gaming, gambling, vice, and narcotic peddling could not exist. The respective responsibilities of the federal government and the state government are clear. The Constitution specifies that police powers within the state are for the state themselves to enforce. The Constitution clearly gives the federal government power to regulate interstate traffic. It has always been and always will continue to be the policy of this administration to back up the states in their inherent police powers by every appropriate measure. We supported legislation to prohibit the interstate shipment of slot machines in violation of state law, and to prohibit the use of interstate communications facilities to transmit gambling information. We already have laws to back up the states in the enforcement of local narcotics and alcoholic laws. The postal laws forbid the use of the mail for transmitting lottery, obscene, or fraudulent material. There are many more measures which need not be cataloged here. On the other hand, I do not want anyone to be deceived that federal action by itself can solve the problem of crime. The primary responsibility rests with state and local authorities and with individual citizens who must obey the laws enacted by their representatives in government. It's vitally important that this nation remain strong morally as well as economically and militarily. I say again, the eradication of crime is a job for every citizen in the country. Now I have a statement on food for India, which I think you'd be interested in, and this one's ready. The other one will be ready very shortly. India has an urgent need for grain to prevent suffering and starvation. This I pointed out in my message of February the 12th to the Congress. My views have not changed. We can, at some sacrifice, spare the grain. We should do so. First, to save human lives, and second, to strengthen freedom and democracy in an important area of Asia. Moreover, we should provide the first 1,000,000 tons promptly as grain. We can then explore in greater detail the situation with respect to the remaining 1,000,000 tons. India must have 6,000,000 tons of grain in order to meet the famine conditions caused by severe drought. India has made arrangements to buy 4,000,000 tons through ordinary sources, including the United States suppliers. To pay for the additional 2,000,000 tons of grain would place too great a strain on the financial resources of India and would prevent the carrying out of its essential development program. In addition, with the provision of grain to India as a grant, the Indian government will deposit the local currency coming from the distribution of the grain to the Indian people into a special account which can be used for agricultural development projects in India, agreed to by us. These projects will help alleviate the recurrence of such conditions as the present. Our Foreign Affairs Committee carefully investigated this matter and on March the 5th favorably reported a bill to provide the grain to India. This bill has bipartisan support. It reflects the desire of the American people to help the Indian people in their present emergency. Prompt action is vital. The monsoon season occurs in India during the summer. Many roads are then made impassable and grain shipments to remote areas are greatly impaired. Each day's delay after April the 1st in starting shipments will leave a serious gap in India's food supply later this summer and cause great suffering. I hope, therefore, that the Congress will enact the necessary legislation as soon as possible as the East region. Now you can ask questions if you like.
President,
do the people who say pretty flatly that you're going to run against it, do you know what they're talking about? I don't think anybody knows what he's talking about, and he talks about my re-election. We'll attend to that in the time
coming, Smith. He predicts that you will be re-elected with 66% of the vote next year.
Oh, that's a nice prediction, but I haven't seen his speech, and I can't comment on it.
It will not clear by the White House.
No. I do.
I mean, anyone but you.
That's right. I didn't say that thing.
How did you know?
Well, I know what I'm going to do, and I'll tell you about it in due time. I don't know why you have to know so far in advance. You know, the Democratic and Republican committees don't meet for July, and they finally make the decision, you know. The president, of course, will have something to say about the Democratic convention, as he did last year. Well, I'll answer that when the time comes. I have no comment. No. He wanted to know if there's any change contemplated in his status as an ambassador, and I said no. How then? No, I've got other things to do besides watch television. I never look at it unless my daughter's on it. I think he made a Clear's report of what the discussion is about when he went out of the office. I have nothing to add to it.
too. But you say whether any real doctrine, whether any real doctrine has been transferred to General MacArthur in the last few weeks in terms of thought of the President's title.
The instructions are as they always have been, Bob, and they are referred strictly to the tactical situation. General Marshall answered that very clearly. General Marshall answered that very clearly yesterday in his press conference.
Now, one other
thing
that
I would
say,
Mike,
based on reports in the last couple of days, that a new statement of policy,
I talked to both of them before they issued their statement, and I knew what they were going to say. General Marshall, of course, is worried about the apparent letdown in the minds of the people that there is an emergency in existence now. The emergency is just as great now as it ever has been.